Welcome to the Afropolitan podcast, hosted by Eche Emole, founder of Afropolitan. On the show, we chat with Afropolitans whose footprints form the foundation of systems dedicated to building the future of a bold and progressive Black community. In each episode, our guests share their working formulas, the hard facts about leaving familiar terrain, embracing the unknown, and staying relevant afterwards. Listen as we extract the blueprints of fearlessness, innovation, and progress.
Hey Afropolitans, in today's episode, we chat with Yida Gao, general partner of Shimmer Capital, an early stage crypto and Web3 investment firm. Yida talks to us about his journey with Shimmer Capital and insights on the venture capitalist environment. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Yida, welcome to the Afropolitan podcast. How are you feeling, man?
I'm feeling good. It's a bear market. Winter's here, but feeling pretty good. I'm talking to you guys.
And we were talking about earlier about how this is like your first podcast interview ever. So thank you again for showing up to the Afropolitan podcast.
Yes. Happy to support our founders for sure.
Speaking of bear markets, how many crypto winters have you been through?
Oh, that's a good question. So I would say probably really gone through the last one. So we started investing into the crypto space in professionally in 2017, dabbled in it a couple of years before, but that winter of 18, 19 into 2020 was definitely eye-opening and a lot of learnings from that.
So walk us through your journey of coming into crypto. What got you inspired to go along with crypto?
So I was born in a small town in China called Shima. It's close to Taiwan, southeast part of China. Moved to the States when I was about 4.5 years old. Grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Went to a school at Boston at MIT, studied math, computer science, econ. And afterwards, worked on Wall Street. So in 2013, worked at Morgan Stanley doing M&A banking, helping divest, acquire for Fortune 500 companies. Quickly realized that I didn't want to be in that industry, which I felt was very backwards. So moved over to venture. I worked at a VC fund called NEA, packed my bags, went over to the West Coast and was there for a couple of years and focused a lot of time in fintech. Part of that was looking at crypto companies or blockchain companies. Couldn't get any deals through the partnership in 15, 16, 17. And so left in 17 and started the first crypto fund called DDC, Divergence Digital Currency. That was more of a hedge fund structure. And so kind of raised capital probably at the worst time because the first month was December of 2017. And then, you know, right after that, the price of Bitcoin started to fall dramatically and we entered a bear market. But it was a good time for us in terms of having capital to deploy into the space. But that's kind of how the professional investment journey started in 17. And then fast forward to today, we are deploying capital out of Shimmer Capital, which is a closed-ended venture fund more focused on backing Web3 founders. And, you know, I went back to the drawing board when I left my last fund last year and said, hey, if we were to start a new fund from scratch, had a clean slate, how would we position ourselves? What's missing in the crypto investment space? And got a team together, and that's kind of how we started Shima last year.
Oh, that's amazing, man. So what would you say then is Shima's investment thesis, especially in its approach to funding startups?
Sure. So when we went back to the drawing board to see what's missing in this space, we realized a couple observations. The first is that there's a lack of talent in the space. You know, you can raise millions of dollars, but there aren't, you know, millions of smart contract engineers to hire, or product developers, or even community managers who are interested in crypto, especially now, you know, in this bear market, you know, it's harder to recruit and people are leaving the industry. So that's one, talent is missing. Two, we think that, you know, crypto is still very retail driven, meaning a lot of the users are going to be, you know, folks on social media platforms, on, you know, messaging platforms like Telegram and Discord. And so how do we help amplify brands and narratives for our portfolio companies and crypto companies? And so that's another piece of the pie that I think it was missing. And lastly, it's just tech, right? There's a lot of different types of architecture that you can have for your Web3 company, different types of L1s you can use, L2, should we build on those? So I think, you know, having a good advisor on the tech side of things is something that we think, you know, founders in the space would appreciate. So those are the thesis points for how we would differentiate as a firm. And then in terms of thesis around what types of companies we want to invest in, we're a generalist fund. So we invest across all the verticals from infrastructure, middleware plays to NFTs, metaverses, gaming, social, and then everything between DAOs, DeFi. We're less industry driven, but more founder driven, especially given our stage, right? Which is seed, pre-seed investments, the first, try to be the first institutional checks when it comes to deploying capital in the space. And so if we're doing that, you know, a lot of it is founder driven. And, you know, the ideas may pivot, may change, but typically the founders don't.
Ida, what would you then say are some of the main criteria for when you choose to invest in a founder?
Yeah, so in crypto, so there are criteria that we look at that are specific for crypto and the ones I think are more general across any type of early stage founding team. So the crypto native things is that in crypto, you see a lot of founders working on a lot of different projects at the same time. And that seems to be the norm. And so one kind of basic thing we look for is, are these founders committed to the company that we invest in, not the, you know, two other ones that they may be working on the side, and they're focusing 150% of their time and energy into, you know, that one company and the one idea that they pitch us on. And you'd be surprised how many founders out there are not doing that. So that's, you know, key. You know, do they have high conviction on that one company versus, you know, two, three other ideas that they have? It's really easy to, you know, start crypto companies. And so I think that's why, you know, people kind of spread their bets. We want to make sure that their bets are in one basket, in one company, the one that we invest into. And then founders that have some sort of differentiated view or access or insights into whatever category that they're investing into, that investing their time into, we're investing our capital into. And, you know, especially in this bear market, it comes down to a lot of the basics, right? Can we trust the founders? Do the reference checks come back of high quality? A lot of investors don't even, you know, do kind of the reference checks we think are critical, right? Of making sure that we back the right team. And this is extremely important now. And I think a lot of investors are starting to see this, which is when the markers are good, you know, everybody's doing their jobs, but when the markets are bad and, you know, your token price goes down 90%, are you backing founders that are going to stick with the project, you know, take the treasury that they have and use it and to good use, increase their runway, or they're going to do something, you know, that is not in the best interest of the investors and the token holders?
We had Elizabeth Ian of Hustle Fund on here, and she said that, because she's been a founder as well as a VC. She said raising for a VC is actually harder than raising for a startup. What would you say the fundraising process was like raising for Shima?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are similarities for sure. And I think also it depends on where you are in the market. You know, if you're raising in a hot market, a lot of investors, LPs are all trying to get into a specific space like crypto back 12 months ago, then it's a little bit easier to raise than, for example, if you're looking to raise now. But if you take a step back outside of, like, you know, raising for a crypto VC fund versus another type of VC fund, a more generalist tech fund or consumer fund, fintech fund, the fundraising process, especially if you're a first time GP or it's your first couple of funds, it's harder to raise, right, for first-time, quote-unquote, founders. And the reason for that is, you know, you may not have the track record to show investors and LPs that you can do this. Luckily for us, right, we had at the time, you know, 5 to 6 years of track record, can show what we've done in the past for the other funds that we've raised for and deployed capital for. But it definitely isn't easy, right? You're putting yourself out there. It's like selling Girl Scout cookies, right? You go to a lot of doors, you knock on a lot of doors. Not everybody's going to buy what you're selling. But if you can frame it correctly and, you know, have the right pitch and the right story, that kind of strings together how you started and why now, and why you're the best positioned GP to steward their capital in the right direction, then, you know, you have a high probability of success. But I think it's also for fundraising for fun. There's a snowball effect. In the beginning, you know, you're dealing with very little capital raise and it's hard to raise. But once you start getting the flywheel going, the snowball gets bigger and bigger. And then you have more momentum, you have more surface area, and your existing investors that have committed can then start making intros to newer investors, potential investors. And so there's a snowball effect. And so the beginning is definitely the hardest. I think it's a little bit easier to close. And so that's been kind of our journey over the last 12 months.
Definitely. So before you transitioned from Wall Street to like VC, would you say you had any misconceptions about being a venture capitalist that you might have changed your mind on? What misconceptions have you generally heard people talk about VC from? And you're like, they don't get it.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I didn't. When I first heard about venture, this was when I was doing banking, and I didn't really understand what it was. Like a lot of back then, right? This is like 2013, 2014. You know, the main jobs out of Wall Street after you do your, you know, 2 years investment banking was private equity, right? And then the second was maybe working at a hedge fund, and third was maybe doing consulting, going back to get a degree as an MBA student. VC was not really that hot back then, like it is now. And so it didn't really have too much of any type of perception or preconceived, you know, kind of notion of what a venture capitalist did. Now there's definitely, I think, preconceived notions of what they do, both negative notions and also positive ones. And so I'm happy to talk about those and what I think, you know, a good venture capitalist should be doing. But back then it was kind of like, oh, you know, you're interested in tech. You have a technical background, you're a comp sci major, and you also have some finance experience. You know, venture might be good for you.
Would you say that there were any like VCs that you were inspired by or you've looked up to in the space?
That's a great question. Not really, because, you know, back then I didn't know what venture capital really was or who were the top, you know, people on what's now I know as the Midas list, right? Of great mm-hmm. venture capitalists that Forbes does a good job of listing out. But working at NEA, New Enterprise Associates, which is the fund I worked at first, was, you know, there's a lot of mentors and people I aspired to working there. What's cool about NEA is that they had VCs that came from all walks of life, not just career venture capitalists, right? You had academics, you had founders, you know, CTOs of great companies, to, you know, people who come from more of a traditional finance background. So it's a good mix of GPs that you can learn from of different styles. So that's what I appreciated working there. And it was a great learning experience.
So a lot of founders struggle with recruiting and retaining talent, right? How have you found and retained the talent on your team at Chima?
Yeah, so talent is definitely everything, right? Especially for early stage company and the people that you hire early on really define the trajectory, I think, of your company or your fund. And so the way that we did it in at Chima is that we had this like trial period where if we interviewed, you know, folks and we liked them and it was the feeling was mutual, we wouldn't immediately give them an offer to join. We would have like a 4 to 6 week trial period where, you know, they would shadow work with us. And because, you know, venture is, it's apprenticeship, right? You kind of learn from doing. And so we had a lot of the folks who joined us shadow us and be part of the team. They would be on a lot of the calls, be in the weekly IC meetings, investment committee meetings, and really just saw if we could vibe culturally and they added to the mix in a positive way. And so there would be no hard feelings if it didn't. And, you know, there wouldn't be like a big, you know, kind of breakup where if we had issued them an offer and all that, and then it didn't work out, you know, it's more of a lift to get out of that contract. So that's kind of how we did it, so that we saw that, you know, the fit was good, because you can only learn so much from somebody from interviewing them a couple of times and doing references. It really takes, you know, working with them day to day to really see if they're a good fit for a small company or a small fund like ours.
Ida, what advice would you have for founders looking to raise, especially in this bear market, especially if they're in the pre-seed or seed stage? What advice would you have for them to navigate the fundraising environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we have a lot of founders right now who are looking to raise capital that are in our portfolio. And, you know, our advice is just raise capital on a rolling basis, right? Don't wait for like a first close or final close. You're always raising as a founder. Doesn't matter if it's a bull market or a bear market. You're always raising capital because that's what fuels the growth in your company. Assuming that you can spend it well, you should always be raising. And Glenn Ross, I think it was a good movie I watched, you know, ABC, always be closing, right? A good quote. And for founders, especially in a bear market, you want to do that in spades, right? Any single meeting that you're in, any single event that you go to could be an opportunity to pitch. You know, investors don't want to be pitched, right? They don't want to be sold. Nobody wants to be sold. So, you know, doing different things, writing content, doing podcasts, you know, getting your name out there is a good way to attract investors where you're not necessarily pitching, but you're just doing, you know, what you would be doing for your company on a daily basis. And you'll, if you're doing a good job and you represent yourself as being very unique and having insights that are differentiated for your specific category, specific vertical, they'll be noticed. So I guess the feedback here and advice is always be raising, especially in the bear market. Don't wait for a, you know, specific event that happens for you to collect the capital, because, you know, there's been a lot of examples where investors agree to invest from a company investment perspective, and also fund investment perspective. Investors in general can agree to invest, maybe even sign the docs, but then renege. And, you know, you're not going to sue them for the most part. It's not a good look, but it's just an unfortunate event, right? The market can turn and then they would renege, or the better case scenario here is that they would just decrease their investment into you. And that's still not good. So if you had called the capital all up front, or right after signing of the docs, have them wire, that's the best strategy. So, you know, as a founder, you should not wait and take for granted a signature as commitment to actually wiring funds for your company.
That's definitely a good point. I know some startups have probably even received term sheets that were then withdrawn, or maybe they didn't follow on through with the investment. Can we talk through the process of, like, when a fund says, hey, we've just closed a $100 million fund or a $1 billion fund, can you break down the process of what the calling the capital looks like? Because a lot of people don't know that just because you've closed a $1 billion fund doesn't mean that $1 billion are in, like, your bank account ready for you to deploy. You actually have to call some of the capital. And sometimes in a bear market, the LPs might not, you know, follow through with that capital. So can you break down some of that nuance involved in that and the logistics?
So yeah, I'll talk about a closed-ended fund, because a open-ended hedge fund, different types of structure and different types of capital call. It's all called upfront. But for a closed-ended fund, typically, the investor doesn't deploy all the capital into that fund all at once. There are capital calls, typically quarterly or, you know, as needed, capital calls into the fund as the GP in the fund needs to deploy that capital. So there's no cash drag, or, you know, the cash isn't just sitting in a bank account. The ideal scenario, right, for a GP, especially in a bear market, is to call all the capital up front if you can. And then you don't have that risk of LPs not, you know, kind of honoring those capital calls. But if you have great LPs that would honor capital calls in a bear market or a bull market, then you don't have to worry about that. So it really comes down to the quality, right, of the LPs that you have. If you have, you know, endowments or fund of funds, you know, professional investors who, you know, understand the legal responsibilities and practical responsibilities of being an LP in a fund and committing to a certain amount and being able to send in the funds when the capital is called, then you're fine. But a lot of funds, and especially smaller funds, micro VC funds that get set up in today's world, you have LPs that are not as savvy. And so when there's a big macro, not just, you know, talking about crypto, but, you know, global macro meltdown that we're experiencing now, and it affects everybody in their bank accounts and their liquidity, that's when you start having issues with LPs and GPs. And nobody wants to, you know, be litigious and sue, you know, their LPs. and they probably wouldn't. So it's just a bad situation to be in, which could be prevented if you were able to call the capital all up front because you already have the capital, right? It's harder to renege and do that when you already have the capital. So the best practice is, as a founder of a company, as I mentioned earlier, is to try to get the funds in ASAP and not, you know, delay that or procrastinate.
Definitely. What would you say is some of the best guidance that Shima offers to its portfolio companies?
In what respect? Best guidance and what?
Best guidance, whether it's through like marketing or runway or just even talent, like recruiting talent. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So there's best practices that we tell our founders, you know, when they onboard with us, we get on a call with all the different departments at Shima, from the talent department to the, you know, in-house community marketing team that we have, to the investment team and the tech team. I'll just try to hit on some of the best practices. You know, from the investment team, we would say, hey, you know, make sure you have at least 18, 24 months of runway, especially in these markets. Assume you won't be able to raise capital for at least, you know, 1.5 years. And, you know, the name of the game right now is to survive the winter and wait for, you know, markets to, and then hopefully be on the uptrend. You know, capital is the lifeblood of any company. So you want to preserve that, you know, make sure that your burn is controlled. Every single employee and every single major expense is kind of warranted. So that's one, right? Controlling your burn so that you can survive the winter. And then have a strategy of like, okay, what are the main milestones that you need to hit before you think, you know, your subsequent round investors, your Series A investors, potential investors, Series B will, in this market or in the next 6 to 12 months, feel comfortable to deploy into your company based on specific milestones. And that should be kind of agreed upon with your existing investors on the cap table, that yes, these milestones, if you hit them, will be sufficient to raise your next round. Because you can agree to that with your investors, who hopefully will have better insights on what subsequent round investors are looking for, then you're kind of shooting in the dark, right? You don't know what you should be aiming for. I'll just mention another thing. On the talent side, I actually think right now is a really good time to hire in crypto and Web3. A lot of layoffs across the board at some of the larger companies out there. So it's a good time to hire. There's still a lot of folks who want to be in crypto. And so if you have the cash, it's a great time. You know, don't rush into it. I think you have, just like as an investor, right, we have the luxury of time to do more extensive diligence and not rush into deals like, you know, 2 quarters ago. But as a founder, right, don't rush into any type of hire, but you do have a larger pool to pull from. And we've seen a couple of our founders have success hiring from unconventional avenues. So not just going through a recruiter or through LinkedIn, AngelList, but on Twitter and on Discord, right? You can find some pretty good folks who are committed, maybe ones that are already in your community that you can reach out to and make an offer for.
Yeah, I know for us at Afropolitan, we spent like 3 days, like literally trawling through Discord channels for designers. And it was interesting because obviously you're used to like maybe going through LinkedIn, but a lot of the talent is right there on Discord and they're also posting their work too. So there's proof of work in there. So you get a chance to like evaluate, like, okay, are you good at this? Or are you great at that? You know, so we live in very unconventional times. That's for sure.
100%.
You know, so everyone gets to deal with failure at some point, right? What would you say was your most significant encounter with failure? How did you deal with it? And what did the experience teach you?
I think top of mind from the fundraising, right? Because we've been talking a little bit about that. And for us, right in the beginning, we were hit with a lot of no's when we were fundraising for Shima Capital. And, you know, that I consider as kind of failures, a lot of micro failures, which add up, right? And it can definitely take some wind out of your sail, especially if your founder trying to fundraise and you think you have a good product and, you know, you believe in your mission of what you're building. And so we were hit with a lot of that in the beginning. You know, as a solo GP, you know, there's questions around that, around, okay, you know, are there way too many crypto native funds out there for the size of the market at the time? You know, lots of doubt. And I think, you know, as a founder, right, raising capital, you know, you will be hit up with a lot of failures in that respect in terms of no's. I would say what I learned from those no's is that, you know, it's all about relationships and the fundraising world. And you don't want to close any doors, and a no now may not mean a no down the road, right? 3 months from now, 6 months from now. So it's really easy to just say, okay, no, all right, let's move on. But if you had a good conversation with a potential investor, keep those relationships because they can pay dividends down the road. You know, make it a process-oriented way for you to raise capital, right? We used, you know, Google Sheets, something very simple to track everybody that we've spoken to. And we made sure to follow up, right? When we had updates about the fund, you know, SPVs that we were raising, to update folks we had good conversations with, because I've learned through this fundraising process that a no now doesn't necessarily mean a no forever. And if you're doing good work and you consistently, push out, you know, good content or good investment, that would be noticed. And so that's kind of the learnings from the last 12 months, is to keep the relationships going and cultivate them over time, you know, especially if you're trying to raise capital from folks, right? It's very difficult, especially in this bear market, to have somebody agree to you, like after a couple meetings with you. So if you were long-term thinking about, your business, you know, those relationships can just compound over time and ultimately lead to a check.
Definitely. So, you know, would you say that there are any like three books that have had a profound impact on your life?
Three. Wow. That's a lots of books. Let me try to think if I can think of one. I think one interesting book, especially since I think, there are a lot of founders that would be listening to your podcast that could be helpful and also investors, is a book that I read recently called Play Bigger, How Pirates, if you think of what we call How Pirates, Dreamers, and Innovators Create and Dominate Markets. By Al Ramadan, and Dave Peterson and a couple of other folks. It's a book that was actually recommended to me. I think somebody at Sequoia Capital, about how, you can make category kings in any industry that exists, that's investable. And I think that was a very interesting book to read about because, you know, everybody is trying to create a product, right? When it's pitch a product and sell a product. But maybe that's not the right way to frame, your business, right? Is, okay, can you build a better mousetrap? But are you building a business that, is actually creating potentially a new category, right? Changing the game. Everybody is, you know, on one racetrack. Are you creating a new type of racetrack and owning that market? So I think Play Bigger was a good book to just, you know, maybe have a different perspective on investing and as a founder perspective on what type of business are you building, right? Are you building a business that has, you know, 1,000 competitors, or are you creating a new category of companies that you are the first mover in? And I think that type of framing could, lead to bigger outcomes and help, you know, change the story and the pitch to something that may be more unique as you go out to market.
Definitely. So, Danita, if the only thing left in the world was to read a book about your life, what would the title of the book be?
I think there could be a couple, but I think maybe one is just like, you know, question every assumption. The way that I've operated and, you know, lived life is doing just that. Not try to, you know, just work based on or operate based on the status quo, but, you know, try to question every assumption from, oh, can we do this? You know, oh, you know, are you too young to raise a fund? You know, what are some of the categories as crypto a little bit too early, you know, question every assumption that you may have. And I think you'll go far with that type of mentality. And the other, I would say the other title would just, you know, be a nice person. And if you can do that, and give more than receive, you know, life is all about relationships. I think who you know as much as what you know. And, I think that is really missed, especially in crypto, right? Everybody is very transactional in this space. It's very short-term thinking. If you can have more of a, you know, be nice mentality and not rug people, then I think that would go a long way.
Definitely. So Ida, Shima is one of the leading investors for Afropolitan, right? What would you say that being Afropolitan means to you, and why did Shima choose to invest in Afropolitan?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, like what I said earlier in the podcast, which is it's all about the founders for us. And I think, you know, you guys have done a really, really good job of creating, you know, this new category and having, you know, kind of thought leadership in the space in a very, very large, you know, emerging market, just like what, you know, Southeast Asia has been able to accomplish in terms of grabbing Web 2, you know, what Afropolitan can do in Web 3 space for Africa is massive. And also the diaspora of the African diaspora and, you know, being thought leaders in this space, which is all about community. I think, you know, what you guys are doing with this podcast and other, initiatives, you know, makes it a no brainer for us, right? Who else has more of a industry insight than you guys? And in this space where it's all about community and Web 3, I think you guys, are doing, you know, a massive amount of legwork and building that community. And in this bear market, right, it's all about heads down building. And I think you guys are kind of bar none in building that community.
Yeah, man, thank you so much for stopping by the Afropolitan podcast. I know this is your first ever podcast. I hope you had a great time so far, man.
Yeah, it's great. And using it on this really cool app, Jamit. So
Yeah,
they do well.
Definitely. Yeah, they will. They will. I'm going to make the intros after as well. And sure. Ida, thank you so much again for stopping by the Afropolitan podcast. It was a pleasure having you.
Yeah, I really appreciate the time, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Afropolitan podcast. We are building the future of a progressive Black community. To join our community, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Afropolitan. Be sure to join our Discord and Clubhouse community by clicking on the link tree on our Instagram page. See you on social.